So one of the things that I get to do once or twice a year over the past several years has been walking people through the material in this class that we teach here called Seek. And so Seek is a class that we offer here now and then for people on the front end of faith who are trying to reimagine faith for themselves or are trying to figure out what finding faith for the first time would look like or finding faith again looks like. We're offering sort of a different version of Seek in January. We're calling Unpack. That'll be coming up in a couple months. And it's been a real pleasure to teach that class now and then. One of the interesting things about these classes we offer for people who are trying to discover or unpack or rediscover faith is they're really different every time because they reflect the stories and the personality and the questions of whoever is there. But one thing I've found again and again, pretty much each time I've had an experience like this with people, is that there's been one bit of material, one set of questions that's been helpful every single time to lots of different people, no matter what they bring in. And that's been this basic concept we talk about of good faith and bad faith. It's almost embarrassingly simple, these binary categories without fancy words like good and bad, and who's anyone else to label faith good or bad? And yet, again and again, people found it kind of illuminating and helpful. The idea of this material has been that there's forms of faith that you might not want, that might be like a curse, not a gift in your life. And these forms of faith we call bad faith tend to make you feel like you're taking a step backwards, right? They're taking you somewhere that you were before that you don't want to go again, or somewhere that seems like you put the car of your life or your mind or your heart in reverse and you wish you hadn't. We say bad faith seems to be based solely on unquestioned authority. So the base of this faith is some person or institution or a book tells you you must believe, and there's really no other reason you have for the faith. And most people feel like, again, that feels like a step backward for them intellectually or relationally. We say bad faith often feels to people like it's arrogant and like it's unteachable. Like, again, there's an authority that has everything there is to know, and they're trying to foist that onto you, and it's arrogant, and it has nothing to learn itself. By contrast, we've talked about good faith as an experience that feels like it comes out of a step forward in your life and leads to more step forward. It's an experience that's taken you places you wanted to go and weren't sure how to get there. It didn't feel like you had the motivation or power or insight to get there. Good faith feels humble and teachable. Everyone in the game has things to learn. It feels honest and authentic and involves other people. It's communal, involves other people in kind of a helpful way. Again, it's almost an embarrassingly simple division, but people seem to find it helpful because again and again, people have encountered, or maybe they haven't encountered yet, but they're wary of encountering forms of religion or spirituality that are going to set them back, that are going to be controlling, that are going to try and answer questions too quickly, that will rely on unquestioned authority, or that one way or another will leave them stuck, will leave them unable to move forward or unable to assimilate new learning or new experiences, unable to help them toward ever-increasing flourishing, which is something we all want for our lives and we'd all want out of faith. This month, we're talking about these kind of questions, faith that moves us forward, faith that moves us backward, in this series that we're calling Let Bad Religion Die, New Ways of Being with God in the World. We're doing this because our supposedly secularizing country is really quite spiritual still. Lots of us are still interested in questions of meaning and mattering and significance, but we're kind of fed up culturally with any kind of system, including religion, that would offer us easy answers or that would do sort of or say kind of crazy or embarrassing things we really can't sign on to, or would feel too narrow, would be seem like it'd be kind of protecting a tribal or a narrow interest that we don't want to be a part of. And so we're asking this month, how can we become not critics of other people's spirituality or religion, but how can we notice within ourselves tendencies toward bad religion, impulses that we can choose away from, and we can instead choose toward being with God in ways that anchor us and lead us toward flourishing in the world. And today I want to move that conversation forward, centering around two different people. One of these people is the archetype of faith for over half the people on earth, the archetype of faith in the Jewish and Christian and Islamic tradition, this being Abraham, the father of our concepts of faith in all three of those traditions. And the other person I want to center around this story is a friend of mine here at Reservoir who's been fascinated by the story of Abraham and who spent his whole 70-something years of life on the road of faith, trying, like Abraham has done, to keep moving forward. And so Abraham is not available in the flesh, but our friend Roger Dewey is. And so why don't we invite Roger to the stage. Let me give Roger a welcome. Hi, Roger.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us instead of Abraham. I'm glad to have
you here.
I'm going to start us off, and where I have stools, we'll see how much we sit or stand, but we wanted to try and be comfortable. I'm going to start off by reading this story in the New Testament about Abraham and some meaning that comes out of Abraham's life. It's in a letter called Hebrews. It's in your program as well. And then I'm going to ask Roger to start telling us about some of his connection to that story. Let's hear the story of Abraham first, though. It goes like this. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old, and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. And therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. All of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confess that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land they had left behind, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. Well, Roger, I am really glad you're here with me today. And I would love for you to start us off by telling us about your connection to this story of Abraham.
Very good. When I was a young teenager, Abraham was my favorite biblical character. And that was because Abraham followed God into a world, a land, a country that he did not know. And as a young kid, I figured that that's what all of life was going to be for me. And in fact, I figured that that's what all of life is for all of us. That we go into a future that we honestly don't know. We might pretend that we do, but we don't really know what will happen. And while we think that there is various kinds of security in this world, we really have no security at all that is real other than this companionship of God. So I wanted to explore to see how much I, too, could actually live that way. Would God be with me no matter what? So at 17, I went to New York City, where I knew no one. I was alone, with the single purpose and intention of sleeping in Grand Central Station. I wanted to get totally outside my comfort zone, and I did. I wanted to see if God would show up. It's a long story, and I'd love to tell it all to you, but there's not time. But, you know, it was a remarkable day, and I realized by experience that Jesus was there with me during that day. And I actually experienced Jesus communicating love in a powerful way to some very, very hurting people. Now, my parents had a very simple faith. My mother was a feminist several decades before anyone else used that word. She was a social worker, And she brought me up with dozens of stories of people who really had very few resources, but they had a lot more hurdles than we did, and she was helping them to get back on their feet. And my dad was a small businessman. He had a small business. And well, he was short, too. But anyway, he had a small business. And I saw my dad spend a half an hour one time convincing a customer that she honestly did not need to buy this $30 item because this particular 50-cent thing put on in the right way would take care of the problem completely and last forever. And I also saw my dad hug a man on the street who frankly smelled so much of urine that I wanted to be anyplace else. But Dad knew that Jesus loved that man equally as much as Jesus loved us. So whenever anything in my life challenged that beautiful, honest, simple faith, I would put it on a little shelf in my head to remember it. I mean, it might be very important, but I didn't want it to derail my exploration of this life with Jesus. So, you see, I saw myself in that really long line of people, ever since Abraham, who had simply walked with God. It was not a big deal. It didn't take intelligence. It didn't take great discipline. There was nothing to it. We simply walked with God each day. So when our minister began preaching about hell, I had a problem because I respected him deeply and still do. But what he was saying didn't sort of agree with the spirit of Jesus that I was beginning to see and to know and to follow. So that went up on the little shelf, that question. It took about 5 years. But eventually, I did think, you know, I could begin to explore this question by going into Latin America and by getting in touch with those people who are making first contact with native people to see what did the people know about Jesus before the missionaries got to them. So it's a long story. It's about 10,000 miles. But in country after country, as I was hitchhiking down through Central America at 24, I was hearing stories of tribes who recognized the spirit that they had already known in the stories that then were being told to them about Jesus. It was the same one. So I figured that while I really didn't understand this hell thing, I could trust that God loved these people who did not know the name Jesus as much as he loved me. I could trust that they had never been abandoned.
That's a good story. I want to get you onto another story, Roger. But before I do, one question about those stories. So most of us who want to learn to trust God more, if that's a question we've asked before, we try different things, but most of us don't hitchhike through Latin America or sleep overnight as teenagers in, you know, urban train stations or whatever. So I'm just thinking, you might be, you know, less risk averse than some of us, but what gave you the security or confidence or whatever to do things like that when you wanted to see if you could trust God like Abraham? Any sense of that? Is there a short version of that question?
Yeah, my mom, when I was about 17, said to me, you know, Roger, your dad and I want you to know that even if someday everything in your life falls apart, and even if you lose everything, and maybe as a result you even do something really horrible, like you murder somebody, we will love you that day as much as we love you today. And God will love you that day as much as God loves you today. And Jesus will never, ever abandon you. I realized basically I spent the next 30 years of my life finding out how much I could rely on that. And it was a wonderful time. Because God is really a very good parent. He doesn't have a conditional love like a lot of people sort of talk as though God did. Depends on how good you are. God is a good parent who, he's better than mine, and they love me without conditions. And God did too. And that's where my strength came from.
I hadn't expected the parenting workshop piece, but that's really helpful. I'm going to try and do that sometime. I'm serious. All right, so after some point after this, you ended up in this city. You settled into life in Boston. You were a graduate student at Harvard. You got into some other things. But tell us the story about how you got into some work and lifestyle, some other things you weren't expecting to do in the city.
Well, yeah, I was a student, a grad student in city planning at Harvard when King was assassinated. And it was spring break, and I was at my parents' home in upstate New York and watching the funeral on TV Sunday afternoon. And I really didn't know that much about King. I was a conservative. I had never heard a talk of his all the way through. But I began to cry. And I couldn't figure out what it was. But I realized that the only words I've ever found to explain the sense of that day was that I felt that God was sharing his sorrow with me. And God was nudging me to be part of an answer to it. And the sorrow was, yes, of course, for King and the black community and so forth. But God's sorrow directed towards me was his sorrow over the racism in the church. And I had no idea what that meant. But I wrote down on a piece of paper that minute, God's sorrow over the racism in the church. And I knew that I had to respond, so I cut my spring break short. There's a miracle right there. Came back to Boston, got started, but I didn't know what. But that week, a black minister said to me basically that I needed to shut up and listen for a while. So I moved into the black community, and I joined his church. And Dr. Michael Haynes became my mentor for many, many years after that. About this time, some people suggested a way it could be helpful. And so I quit grad school in order to join their tiny inner city nonprofit that didn't pay any salary. And some of my relatives were really, really pretty aghast at that. But I had found a vision for my life. I'd found something that was much bigger than me that I could be involved with, even though I didn't understand what I was doing. And so it was marvelous. But what we did in that little nonprofit was we tried to raise money to send black students to Christian colleges. If we'd been a little smarter, we might have understood what we were getting into, because the Christian colleges drew most of their students from suburban and rural churches. So they were white. And most of the kids in those schools had never even met a black person. So when we sent the kids there, it was like the first week they started getting racist notes under their door in the dormitory or slid in their mailbox. And we made some phone calls and discovered this was really widespread. And so, long story short, we organized a national convention. We flew in black students from the major 30 Christian schools all around the United States. And we decided that we would let them tell, and then we would help them tell their stories to get this out. We had a magazine that we had developed a few months before this, started called Inside, the Voice of Christians Inside the City. Well, by this time, I knew enough to know that what I was dealing with was really, it was dynamite. And so I sent the draft of the issue out to my board. My board was largely the leadership of the main white churches in Boston, and some black churches, but I was new here. And so Everything erupted. Not to me. Nobody said anything to me. But they all called Dr. Haynes. And so Dr. Haynes called me in. And in his typical marvelous way, he said, "Roger, the board has told me to tell you to cancel this issue. So I have told you what the board told me to tell you. But my advice to you is that you listen to what God is telling you." So we published the issue. And it wasn't long before I heard myself referred to as a communist. And even more weird, referred to as a socialist who believed that all of the poor should be given free furniture. I mean, how evil can you get? Powerful people can ignore you a very, very long time. And if you're really persistent, they'll try to discredit you. And if you're still more persistent, and a few people begin listening, they'll try to make symbolic moves that suggest that they understand what you're saying and they agree and that they're responding, but which in effect have absolutely no difference at all. And that's what I saw.
Wow. So we can laugh now at the free furniture and communist stories as I have when we've met. It sounds very 1970s, 1980s, but we think, well, it was, and those didn't feel like good things to hear in those times, right? I mean, you were misunderstood and rejected by lots of people whose opinion, relationships, power had been really important to you. And this reminds me, in fact, of Abraham in another way, how God gave Abraham this outsized dream to cherish. In his case, that the blessing of all the earth and the whole human family would come through his descendants. But then the guy could barely have a single child. The author of Hebrews tells us all of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed they were strangers and foreigners on the earth.
And it hurts that the Bible says that this man who was my age was as good as dead.
I don't think I have anything to say about that. I'm so sorry. So how I can relate, I've never been a political exile. I've only been called a communist in joking, I think, not in a serious way. But I've experienced rejection, for sure. I expect most of us in the room have experienced significant rejection at some point. I've experienced specifically the religious forms of rejection and how they can sting. And it's like, I know when that rejection stings, it's like we have this toxin in our body all of a sudden we didn't ask for. It's not our fault we got stung, but there it is for us to deal with. So I can only imagine what years and years of religious rejection felt like, Roger. So maybe you could tell us some of what that did to you.
Well, yeah, some of us became pretty self-righteous. I became very proficient at quoting the Bible verses about justice that put down those people that were distrusting me and that made me feel superior to them. It took me many years before I realized that none of us have actually arrived. None of us have the right to look down spiritually at someone else, even when that person is at that extreme that we've just been talking about. Today, I spend a lot of time and energy trying to talk to those who disagree with me, because when I do that, it's almost as if, in some ways, it's like I'm talking to the 40-year-old me. I mean, God was very patient with me when I was that age. And God's very patient with me now. So I need to be patient with people and hope that he will bring them along as well.
I take a little offense that you look at people in the 40s as young and immature. So we're even now.
I'm sorry, that's the truth. But lots of good stuff happened in those decades as well. I mean, I married my best friend and counselor, Claire. The postman of our area bought a house so that Claire and I would move into it and start our intentional community. Two awesome children were born to us. Our little community began the Boston branch of Habitat for Humanity. Some of us a bit later helped create jobs, helped low-income people create their own jobs, about 22 of them. So lots of good things were happening. But we did continue to experience some distress and some injustice. And sadly, most of that was at the hands of other Christians. It took us time and energy. But we learned to begin, at least, to love our enemies. We learned to begin to forgive those who actually had hurt us. Jesus was our defense. But some of those pains really hurt. And they caused scars that lasted. But our faith in Jesus was powerful.
That's rich, Roger, to hear about the scars right alongside the blessings, the really positive things in those years. If I can, I almost feel bad bringing it up, but I want to ask a little more about the scar side of things before we move on. You continued at this work of faith people call urban ministry, living in Boston, seeing how your faith, your entrepreneurial skills could impact people and communities for good. But you've talked about with me quite a bit, you've written about this, that things didn't always go well, that there were difficulties and failures in the decades of that work now and then. Could you tell us just a little bit about that or what that felt like?
Yeah. It's no secret. Everybody that knew me knew about them. Basically, this period of time, I tried five different times to write my life story. But it never seemed to come out honest or complete. It was always so biased. And then I heard this man's comment that he regularly seeks to be embarrassed because only when he looks at what has the power to embarrass him and he looks at it without being defensive at all, can he really understand his relationship to God. And it took me a while to realize that what that's talking about is what's most important in life. And so when I came across that quote, the book that I'd tried to write for five times almost wrote itself. The first section was ego, and it was all those stories that I told over and over again that put me in a great light. But the second section was embarrassment. And it was various stories, too long to go into, but stories of being fired and of being clueless and being inadequate and being manipulated. But that was the reality.
I've told you this, but I really love that book, Roger. It's called No Delusions. I read it in 2 or 3 hours in a coffee shop in my neighborhood, and I'm reading this section, embarrassment, and coming towards the end of it. And a friend of mine comes along, the father of one of my kids' friends, guy I'm really only kind of casual acquaintances with. And he saw me reading this book and like tears sort of streaming down my face. And he's like, what are you reading? I told him part of your story. Because I think some of what's so moving to me about the book is that you're so honest with things in your life you consider embarrassments. But they don't, you don't ever see them as the end of your story. There's no, like, the faith journey, the moving forward doesn't stop. There isn't a despair that kind of cuts it off. That's why we give that book out to people when we hold welcome dinners here, partly because the end of the book where you talk so winsomely about our church and your story of faith here, that's a good pitch for us. But I think especially because that embarrassment section, what an incredibly honest and beautiful picture of faith it is. I'd love for you, though, to tell us, Roger, how you started to find peace or what I think you call convergence, coming out of that season of embarrassments?
Well, yeah, it wasn't that long ago. All of the pains, the hurts of so many years began to somehow resurrect. This was about 7 years ago. Began to somehow resurrect and come together and build in power and almost dominate me until one night I shut myself off in a distant room and I yelled at God for hours. This was the year that our church lost a great pastor who was a good friend whom I loved. And it was the year of the Haitian earthquake, and a Haitian person told me terrible stories of suffering. And an African pastor told me of 2,000 people that he knew who had died of AIDS while they prayed for healing. And some young people that I knew in Boston were being terrifically bullied. And I took all of these accusations and threw them at God time and again. And I was angry at the fact that he seemed silent, and it seemed as though he had no power. And the anguish inside rose up until finally I screamed at God, "How can you stand it? I can't." And I got exhausted, and I was on the floor, and then at some point an idea came, or a vision, or dream, or something, I don't know, but an idea came that helped me begin to see all of these terrible things, but through the eyes of God. And it was different, because it was the image of a birth canal. Now, all of us pass through this very short time of terrific pain, and for the woman, there is no worse pain. And I've seen that twice. But for most of humanity, all of life is like a 6-inch birth canal. The whole thing from beginning to end is crying out in pain. For most people on this world, and most people who have lived, all of life is starvation and abuse and war. But this image of the birth canal suggests that even for them, or maybe especially for them, the promise of eternal joy with God, like the woman who has given birth, the ecstasy of that overwhelms all of the pain that they have experienced in life. And that is a remarkable vision. But basically, since I came up with this, or since this idea came to me, it has been the only way that I can see that God is a God both of love and justice. And that gives me the strength to go on, and the hope and the faith to go on into my future.
I'm appreciative of you sharing that story, Roger, because I think that moments like that, when we're sort of on the edge of despair, where all we could do with God is to yell at God, I think we call those moments, if we call them anything, moments of losing our faith. But that seems like, oh, that's like a moment of moving forward. That's a moment of good faith, that there's a form of faith that denies reality. That's to hold it at bay. But in your case, faith gave you freedom to yell at God, and faith gave you freedom to wait in the, to not just walk away then, to wait in that room for some kind of answer. Um, And it gave you hope in, I think, what our passage today promises us, that there's a God who's taken us somewhere better. A friend, Tom Wasink, talked about this passage last month when he was here, yeah. And talked about this faith, this hope that God will set things right in the future is related to this God that is always, that this is the definition of faith, that God is responsive to us, whatever we bring to the table, that God welcomes our presence, however we are, and interacts with us in response to us. Having a little moment of decision here. Can I skip a story and talk about your upcoming trip?
Yeah.
All right. Come back second service for another cool story if you want. But I want to get you to this trip you're about to take, because I think that's important to mention, because people are going to wonder where you are, and it's a good story too. So Roger's become a good friend of mine over the past 5 or 10 years, I think because of the peace you carry and the faith you carry, the connection to Jesus you carry. You've been really good to me, Roger. And I'm going to miss you because you are taking a big trip. And I'd like to hear how, for you in your 70s, the journey of faith and moving forward is not over. Like, why aren't you going to spend the winter in front of your wood stove? What are you doing?
We have a fire almost every night. Well, when I wrote these books, short books that people can read in apparently 2 hours.
Maybe I read it a little too fast. I'll go back. Don't worry.
One of them was titled The Hitchhiking Diaries. And it was the story of that hitchhiking trip down through Latin America. And a story that I actually wrote when I was 24, and it was voluminous with lots of sophomoric sermonizing and all sorts of stuff. And every decade since, I've edited out some of the stuff until finally what I published was 32 short stories, which were sort of interesting. So my wife read the story, the book, and then she said, you know, maybe we should follow your footsteps 50 years later. And so I thought, boy, did I marry the right woman. So, yes, this January the 4th, we take off. We're going to fly to Mexico City, and we are going to start a 4-month trek through Central America. We call it, she and I together call it a walk, but I'm sure we'll take some buses and other stuff. We will do our fair share of walking and maybe even a little old hitchhiking. But we will not be planning it ahead. In other words, each night, each day, we will not know where we're going to stay that night. We will expect God to nudge us a little bit, to say, talk to those people over there. Walk over here and whatever. And this is the kind of experience that we have had and frankly still do, the experience of walking with God, trusting that He will be there and He will help us no matter what. And so that's what we're going to do. Our hope is to repeat the sense that I had back then, which I found it a sentence in my book, which said at near the end, and this is what we hope to repeat. I have learned on this trip, I said, that I can take virtually nothing for granted in life, except that Jesus will never, ever leave me. And that's exactly what we want to experience again on that trip. And I want to add that no matter what style of life you have, I mean, sure, not everybody wants to do these kinds of things, but in our own way, all of us, without exception, can know that God will never, ever abandon us, no matter what. And that should give you the same joyous level of hope that it has given me in all of these years.
Thanks, Roger. It feels almost pedestrian, but can we wrap things up with a few tips? Is that all right with you?
Sure.
All right, we'll do these quick. Why don't you pull out your program? If you want, so you can at least see them there. They're partly filled in. Here's some of what I make of Roger's story and how we can maybe put it into practice, whatever age we are, wherever we are. But I call it a practicing faith that will keep you moving forward. So the first one is to stop and ask yourself this week, where is God leading me forward? Like, what's the invitation before me right now that I sense? We've heard several of those from Roger, but what's the one that God is working and trying to get my attention around right now? Where is God leading me forward? And second, go sleep overnight in a train station, or try doing something to move forward, something that won't go well without God's help. I love, Roger, that you mentioned this freedom. Like, whatever our lifestyle is, whatever our phase is, but try doing something that won't go well without God's help. Thirdly, as I was saying, something I admire about Roger's security and freedom, hard as it is, pay attention to your failures and disappointments. They are great teachers, right? We want to avoid those things. We want to block them out. But they have an awful lot to say to us, don't they? Yeah. And lastly, keep asking God your hard questions when you have them, and keeping expecting God to meet with you in this. I think there's a difference between shouting the question and walking away and waiting in the room for God to answer, knowing that God's glad to be with you there. So, Roger, as we wrap up, would you mind praying for us? Can I give you the honor of doing that?
Sure.
Thank you.
God, I'm grateful for the way that you've led me, which really hasn't depended much on me at all. But thank you. And I pray that all of us will know each day this sense of walking through that particular day, that particular incident with you, aware that it really isn't that big a deal. It doesn't require great patience or intelligence or perseverance or discipline. It simply says, admit when you feel that maybe you're going to mess up, that maybe things are poor, that maybe you're not going to have what you want, and trust that God is with you. Just as I trusted that God would be with me in talking today, because I didn't bring much to this day, but I had to trust God's presence and pray, Lord, that each of us will trust your presence in our life this day. Amen.